we were texting, you know, I had a podcast. Hey, is there anything we want to talk about? Customer service, how we communicate, and the overlap between a bear's ability to figure out puzzles and lower limits of the reading levels of national park goers.
Yeah. So, okay. So...
Hey, Pronosis, welcome back to the show. We've got Zach Korn, VP of Sales and Customer Service on From Barrel Maker Printing, the show, sharing a lot of good tidbits, things like optimizing inbound, things like hiring and red flags, which I feel like is really important. You're almost like hunting for red flags when you're hiring, training, comp plans. Gosh, we dive into a lot of the front office stuff. What was your favorite part?
I just think Zach, the way he approaches sales, like he's so logical about it. And the way he talks about like hiring employees and training them and what he's looking for in them and like things that could go wrong and things that could go right. Zach's an incredibly talented salesperson, but he also works with like an incredible amount of intentionality, when he's training salespeople. And I think that's, a lot of the success at Barrelmaker goes to what Zach has built there. So super cool to chat with him on it.
Real quick, we've got a couple partners that always help us put on a fun show for you guys. First up is Multicraft Daddy. Multicraft Daddy is on Instagram at multicraft_daddy. Guys, you know the drill. If you haven't won yet, you need to open up your Instagram app and you need to send him a DM on Instagram and put in your email address so that Dave can not only be able to pick you as a winner, hopefully, but can also tag you in all of his new dad videos and dad reels and dad jokes, which are awesome. And I appreciate you being able to do that, Dave. Multicraft screen printing and digital supplies have been around for 50 plus years, providing the industry with top brands at competitive pricing. Plus, you mentioned the Printavo Pod that gets you an extra 10% off your first order.
Dave has almost 1,150 followers.
Yeah, he's a posting maniac right now. It's great.
Maniac. Easy way. Are you spending hours cleaning dirty screens? Well, spending hours cleaning screens is a thing of the past. With Easy Way screen printing and screen cleaning chemicals, their innovative formulas are designed to work quickly and effectively so you can spend less time cleaning and more time creating. Plus, Easy Way is passionate about empowering printers of all skill levels. They offer helpful resources and expert advice to help you succeed in screen printing. We use Easy Way at Campus Inc., 701-842. It is the easiest way. It is the only way. Go shop Easy Way. Thanks so much, Easy Way.
DGIapparel.com. It's a new software platform that hit the industry. It helps you be able to easily manage purchasing. It saves so much time. Not only that, it's integrated with Printavo now, so it's sucking out all those orders that you need to be able to handle purchasing for. You can compare pricing, inventory, ship times across different apparel suppliers and pull your exact prices as well, because you'll connect up your accounts to them. Not only that, DGI is free. DGIapparel.com costs you $0 to use. You could sign up, DGIapparel.com, and join the other 1,500 shops using it to save time and money on their purchasing.
All right. GraphicSource. I was just with Nick Wood yesterday, and he was looking great. If you need a solution to improve efficiency and reduce costs in your art department, you should hit up GraphicSource. They are Campus Inc.'s back-end art department, as well as several other hundreds of Printavo shops. They plug and play with Printavo and other shop management software. And when it comes to SEPs, mocks, creative art, order management, embroidery, digitizing, back office admin, and customer service, there's no better company in our industry to work with. They have over 40 years in the game. They have a proven track record of success. You can hit them up. Tell them that we sent you, and you can use the code PRINTAVOPOD24 for 50% off your first vector, SEP, or embroidery order. Thanks so much, GraphicSource.
All right, let's jump on in. Mr. Zach Korn, welcome to the show. Appreciate you being here. VP of, or is it just VP? I wrote VP of sales, but I saw your titles.
It kind of depends on what I'm doing, you know?
Okay.
VP of service and sales, though, is what we go by.
I like that. VP of service and sales. Because that's actually what we wanted to talk about today. Customer service and sales.
I'm in.
You're out of Chicago, Buffalo Grove area. You've been with Barrel Maker Printing, which we've done a few episodes with Justin and with Aaron in the past. I think a shop tour, podcast episodes. Justin, I think was one of the first maybe 10 or so shops maybe that I met through, you know, moving to Chicago and working on Printavo and all that. And it was very kind, and it was crazy, you know, watching your guys' journey going from, you know, smaller shop to bigger Chicago shops and now even bigger suburban shop. Although I know Justin always pitches the idea of going back to the city or, you know, expanding or whatever. You spent a lot of time at Sharprint as well, which we'll get into. So you've had a really, really long journey in this industry.
Yeah, I started actually printing shirts whenever I was like 15 for, you know, punk bands. I wanted shirts. I didn't know where to get them. So I learned how to do it in high school, and I really stayed in the industry except for 9 months at Groupon. I've been in the industry since college. So it's been a while, which is, it's been real fun. It's changed a lot.
And Zach, as far as, you know, there's Barrel Maker Printing, and then there's also liveprinting.com. Which if anyone follows liveprinting.com, you guys do a ton of crazy activations. Great domain. Is that also under your purview as well?
Yeah. I do a lot of for that stuff. Whenever we're marketing it at like big events, I always go to those. I like talking about it, that stuff face to face. I don't do a lot of the logistics on it. But actually in my interview, we had only done like whenever I was interviewed with Barrel Maker, we didn't own liveprinting.com yet. But we had done a couple live printing gigs and we didn't know how to talk about it. We didn't know what else was going on within the industry. And I remember in my interview, we were like, hey, we have this thing that we're kind of doing. We did it like, you know, an opening for Brooklyn Boulders and we did it out of college, you know, if you kind of know how to make this bigger. And, It kind of grew from when I started, not, you know, necessarily because of me at all, but we've grown it since I've been there. So we've always been doing it, but it definitely exploded whenever we put some more time into it over the COVID slowdown.
And just give listeners a little bit of scale of Barrel Maker. You can flex your how many autos and how many live events. Like quickly give us your
your metrics, track record. You know, 6'5", 220.
People always ask that, and we always give them fake answers because I don't actually think that that matters as much. Because, like, if you're not running three shifts, who cares, you know? But we have three autos. We have, we run one manual, but because of live printing, if I need to, I can say we have like dozens of manual presses. We have a bunch of embroidery heads. We have two locations, and we have employees in three or four states. And we do live printing all over the US, and we've just done our first international one in London. So we're starting to go worldwide with live printing, and really excited about that.
And the live printing is like laser engraving, live embroidery. Like it's not just like bring a screen printing press and like set up shop. These are like large operations.
Yeah. It's definitely anything from somebody's, you know, bar mitzvah all the way up to like Adidas taking over the Nike sponsorship for the University of Washington. It seems like if you're in the industry that it's very easy to talk about, but the easiest way to describe it is it's the hibachi of screen printing. That's like the way to talk about it.
Love that.
Yeah. You got people flipping squeegees and stuff. It's about you're still getting fried rice, but you're getting to watch it be made, you know?
That's great. I think a lot of the growth of, you know, Justin's a great human being. Aaron's a great human being. You know, you're a pretty cool human being, but you have always been like in this sales driving role and have like professionalized the Barrel Maker sales process. Can you talk, you said you spent a little bit of time at Groupon. Did that have any impact on your career in sales?
100%. Yeah. It's funny. I read a book before Groupon called Spin Sales or Spin Selling. If you've never read it and you do sales, it's worth a read. And any time that I've ever taken sales training, it's really just that book and they're repackaging it and selling it to the company. So like I took a 3-week sales class at Groupon whenever we were hiring a lot of people. And like maybe the second week I kind of raised my hand. I was like, is this just spin selling? And the dudes that were they were contracting out to that had obviously like sold the sales class package to Groupon for probably, you know, millions of dollars were kind of like, oh, we've been found out. Like we just read this book and are teaching Groupon how to do it. But yeah, I mean, that's really the boiler maker, you know, the boiler room, 50 calls a day, you know, numbers are everything. Asking questions that really like developed kind of the how-to sales. I learned it from, you know, a Southern company. I learned it from people that kind of learned it through like black market sales. Like that's my original sales background. And then I learned like the real process through Groupon, which was very much so like, just if you're not dialing, you're not smiling. You know, that's what the big thing was.
What do you mean by black market selling?
Just like people that, you know, people were like, I remember in an interview for one of my first sales jobs, it was like, you know, do you have any experience in sales? And I was like, well, I sold a little bit of weed whenever I was a kid. And I was like, oh man, that was really a big risk. And then the owner was like, that's how I knew how to sell. All right. Okay, cool. Yeah, we're on the same page. And it was like, oh, sweet. I'm going to get along with these guys. And, if you're selling anything, the only really difference in sales is if you're selling something that you can hide in a closet that no one is going to judge you based on your purchase decision versus something that is more than a necktie. It's something that when you purchase it, somebody is going to judge you based on your decision. You can't hide the fact that you made that sale. Those are two different types of sales. Other than that, it's all the same. Like it's either small, no one's going to judge you on it, or you will be judged based on your decision-making process. To me, that's the type of sales. And there's different ways to do each one of those, but that really only varies on who you're selling to, not what you're selling.
What do you feel like you do differently that you've taken from this when, you know, working at Barrelmaker, right? Like an actual job, like what is the exact tactical thing that you think it's like, okay, well, most people are probably going to respond like this, but I approach it like that.
Yeah, I think most places that I've sold to, when I started really selling equipment, it was during 2008, right after the economy crashed. So I was selling equipment in a time that buying equipment was extremely risky. So it was a hard sell. And then with Groupon, there was a lot of media behind Groupon ruining businesses. And sometimes it was good for businesses, but sometimes it ruined businesses. So
I remember that.
So it was a hard sell. And it was very much like, let's get in there. Let's get behind people's kind of psyche and let's kind of like dig little holes. With Barrelmaker, I know that we're the best. And it's a much easier sell because I don't try to get in there and convince you to sell. I just try to get to know you. And then eventually you're going to see the shirt that I'm wearing or you're going to, I'm going to see the shirts that you're doing. And it's kind of really just the conversation that I have naturally anyways with people. If I'm actually going to go out and pound the pavement, you know, it's really just bringing some stickers, doing stuff like that, chatting with people. Where in other screen printers in the past, especially more old school printers, you know, they're like, have a big, huge rack of all of these samples, walk into a client and convince them to look at like each sample and feel. And it's like, if I'm trying to convince people that our printing is okay, I'm already way behind the eight ball. Like, I don't want to have to do that. All I want to do is get you to realize that I'm reasonable to work with, that there's no friction, and obviously our quality is good. Like if our quality and our service isn't good enough to make you happy, like we wouldn't have the reviews that we have, we wouldn't have the employees and like the benefits that we're able to offer all of our employees. So I kind of give that as like a given, and I do it as in jewelry sales, I think in maybe car sales, they call it the assumed close. You know, they just kind of just be like, well, which one are you going to get, this one or this one? Like, do you think you're going to do the upgrade or you're not going to do the upgrade today and you're just going to go with the regular one? Like the assumed close, I assume that I'm the best fit for you, you know, and that's, as long as I assume that, then everything else kind of falls into the place.
So Zach, like you are, you know, if we were to put you up on like the MVP of salespeople in our industry, you're probably in the Hall of Fame, right? Like you're speaking to Kevin Baumgart. You're speaking the Kevin Baumgart language, right? Like Kevin's probably listening to this, like, you know, whatever, getting hot and bothered. How much of your time is actually spent selling directly versus teaching salespeople and managing the team and actually like teaching them how to do all of this?
These days, probably not as much as Justin wants me to. I know it's always like, hey, will you do more sales? And I'm like, yes. But then I get pulled into HR and I do some operations too. So, you know, like all day yesterday, I was dealing with two specific clients. You know, that wasn't really sales, but giving them a good experience is certainly going to nurture their sales in the future. Like I wouldn't have done it if they weren't somebody that had a mega amount of sales to give me going forward. But I wouldn't consider that sales. I would consider that service. And even in some ways, I would just consider that operations because I'm really just liaisoning between them and production. As far as like actually sales, I would say about one day a week. I try to go out and actually like, what I do is just pick a cool neighborhood, a neighborhood that I want to hang out in anyways, a neighborhood that has a couple of things that I want to do, you know, and I'll go to those places that I want to do and just look at the places around that I also want to stop in at. And as far as anybody's concerned, when I'm stopping in, they're not seeing it as a salesperson stop in. Like they're seeing it as a guy that's either blowing off work or doesn't have work today, that's stopping in to look at candles, that's like curious in a weird way, but also is going to give me stickers, you know? So I've trained a couple people on this and they're very much like, oh, this is really weird. This isn't like a sales tactic. It's like kind of hanging out. And it's like, well, yeah, I mean, if you don't love to do it and if you don't like look forward to it, you're not going to do it. And if you don't do it, then that's it.
So this is outbound. This is considered your outbound sales strategy, which I want to dig a little bit more into this because literally my question says, your boss comes to you and says, we need more sales. What do you do? And it sounds like you're already answering this, right? So I just want to like, okay, so the exact, you know, sort of steps almost, right? So picking an area, it's somewhere local. You're not going through some sort of list and you know, going the cold email route and doing that one, or you find that local is a little easier because, you know, you have commonality there, like you said, to get to know someone.
The cold lists and like the cold emails and stuff, that should already be automated. Like those people are already getting emails. And if there's interest, we're on it, you know, so that stuff's already happening. And if you don't have like drip campaigns, or you're not working on like HubSpot or some sort of like inbound marketing campaign, honestly, I would start there because I think that a lot of our sales comes from just inbound marketing and then having really good service people that know how to attack, extract, and like really work with those people. And then as far as like, yeah, cold stuff, with Groupon, you would spend like a day trying to come up with places to go sell to and qualifying them and doing all that and then going through each one and individually. That also can work, but I think it depends on your personality and who you're selling to. Like if you're trying to sell to car dealerships, you're not going to just find a row of car dealerships and walk in and expect to do it. You're going to try to be a little bit more tactical. Where if I'm selling to retail shops, or, you know, if I'm selling to, let's say, ASI companies and I'm trying to get contract work, I am going to set appointments. I'm going to try to set appointments. I'm going to try to set up a presentation and do it that way. I'm not going to stop in. If it's restaurants, I'm going to stop in, but you have to be really tactical about what time you stop in. You know, you can't stop in at lunchtime. You can't stop in at dinner time. You can't talk to just the hostess. It's not going to work. You know, you have to walk through the door that the cooks are smoking cigarettes at. That's the only way to do it.
So Zach, I want to ask, like, you talked about having like different thing, you know, there's like these different playbooks, you know, you've got the, I'm playing hooky and going into restaurants. I might be doing something targeted for a specific niche. I might have drip campaigns running. I feel like a lot of shops that want to start professionalizing their sales org, try things for a week and then like give up on them. Like what, you know, what, I guess, what do you have to say to that? Is there an amount of time you have to let something run before you see results? Do you actually track a lot of it? Is it just a collection of a lot of different things? Like, how dialed are all your different playbooks that you run?
The sales stuff isn't super dialed here. We don't, you know, if I hire somebody to do sales, I like to give them a month. There's sometimes if I'm seeing activity and there's a lot of activity and there's like quotes out and stuff that's being worked on, I'll give them a little bit longer. If it's somebody that doesn't have any experience, doesn't have a book of business or anything like that, I do like to try to give them a longer amount of time, especially if they're helping with anything else. Like if they're also like getting pictures for social media or adding other some sort of value. With drip campaigns or something new or a new process in general, even if it's not sales, you do have to do it. You can't do it for a week and then be like, nothing's working. This isn't working. I'm going to stop. Because then you're just going to try a bunch of stuff. You're not even going to get to the point of kind of accumulation. You're just going to kind of, you're only going to collect data on if it was hard or not to start it. Like nothing works in a week. But door knocking and stuff, you know yourself, like, is there going to be quotes going out? Like if I stopped and saw 10 people, were three people interested and want pricing, or was there nobody there that even was a decision maker or was interested? Like you can tell right off the bat. If I have a team of people going out and doing sales, that really is just looking at how many activities they actually did and talking to them. If there's a bunch of like, oh, I have this, I did this, but none of it is in, you know, a CRM, then it didn't really happen. You know, so it's, I feel like it depends on what it is, but a lot of times it is, you have to do it for a little bit longer.
So when do you, because there's this always like, how much pressure do I put on my salespeople, right? They're like, your salespeople are always going to push back on you, right? Like Kevin works with our sales team and they find every reason why a sale won't be made. And he'll say, well, you closed 2 out of 10. Sounds like that's a 20% close rate. So like people were saying yes, right? How much of it is pushback versus like motivating them, like setting up games for them to do, like being a little bit of a ringleader, I guess. How much of that are you actually doing to like make them successful?
With most of our team is just inbound service people. We do have stuff like, hey, if anybody can close a certain amount of stuff, or here's a lead, if you close it, we'll give you $50 or $100 or like little things like that. But we don't have like a big sales team to kind of play them off of each other. At Groupon, it was a different story. It was very much like, okay, for the next 2 hours, nobody's allowed to leave their desk. Everybody has to make calls. Whoever makes the most calls that are 2 minutes or longer gets an iPad. Or whoever makes the most calls in the next 2 hours gets $200. It's in this basketball hoop. You can go up, slam dunk, take the money out of it. And, you know, nobody would leave the desk. Like, but there, it was a much different culture. Like there, it was very much... you had the media paying attention. You know, you had people next to you that were making millions of dollars in sales. You know, it was a much higher stake. You know, like my territory at Groupon was Spokane, Washington. So I wasn't making millions of dollars, but like the next room over, a woman, her territory was Manhattan. You know, when we moved out of that business, that building, she was like, I don't want to move. And they built a room around her and rented a unit of that office space. So the next tenant, she was like, I don't want to move desks. And they were like, no problem. We'll rent this from the next tenant. It was just a different vibe. So
it's a cooker.
We don't have. Yeah.
It's a Wolf of Wall Street.
Yeah. And it was funny. If you saw her, like you wouldn't think, you know, she's a very shy, tiny woman. She had Manhattan. You know, if I had Manhattan, I would be a millionaire too. It's not, she did really good, no shade, but if I was doing what I did in Spokane in Manhattan, the scale of it would be differently. You know, it would be different.
I feel like anyone who has work experience at, like, I've had some employees that worked at Yelp and they had a gong they would hit at the front of the room and like everyone would cheer and like they'd have power hours. I feel like anyone that has some experience cold calling, when you're hiring a salesperson, if they lasted at one of those companies for like over a year or two, most of the time they've developed some thick skin, right? Do you see any like downsides of hiring those type of people that have been in those like big machines?
Well, I think when you talk about downsides or pros or benefits or cons, it's really easy to get into the binary of good and bad. And I feel like the one thing that I always try to do with work, business, personal life is kind of look at things through like a Hegelian dialectic, which means like I like the synthesis of both sides rather than either side. I think that people that come from those places can be really, really good because they're rigid, or they can be real hunters, and they can also be really bad because they're rigid. They can be hunters. You know, like there's people that are amazing at certain things because they're so rigid, but that rigidity makes them not great at other things. And that doesn't mean that it's like, hey, they're not great at everything, let's move them off. You just have to know their limits and know that like certain people are closers and they're amazing, but at some point you're going to have to jump in and talk to a client because the client's like, this thing that I'm trying to do doesn't fit into the box that this person is trained on. I mean, we don't make widgets. You know, if we made widgets, sure, put them on it all day long. They can say yes or no. But there's one client that you would say no to that if it was somebody else, you would say yes to. And they don't, they're not able to hold that nuance. So a lot of people with those big, in those big cold calling boiler room type stuff are a little bit too rigid. Now, people in the management side of it, I feel like they can hold that nuance a little bit more and they can see, you know, well, in the grand scope of things, or if we back up and look at this whole thing, maybe our answer or response is going to be different. But other people will be like, well, this is what it says in the price list, even though they're Walmart, you know, I'm going to still just stick to exactly what this price. I can't budge. And it's like, well, look at who they are. Look at what they do. You know, look at the grand scope of things. So I don't like to get into like, this is a good thing, this is a bad thing. I like to kind of think like just where this person's limits on these particular things.
I find similarly, at least folks that are coming from a much larger company, when they're really getting in the weeds and writing things down, emailing and calling, they tend to bring that corporate voice, I like to call. And I'm like, well, you know, you have to understand the other 15 emails that this person has in their inbox also read just like yours do. So pretend like you're just emailing your neighbor. Like what would you say to them? You know, you'd probably shorten this. You'd probably be more to the point. You'd probably make it a little less informal and send that off. But those are really great points about hiring though. So, you know, when you're trying to hire someone to do account management, you know, sales, customer service, that kind of blended role, right? Because a lot of folks, obviously, you're going to have one, two people that are going across the board with this. What are the red flags and green flags that you can hear? And like, how do you sift those things out as quickly as possible when you're interviewing?
And maybe like, Zach, you guys, you've probably hired and fired a lot of employees. Like,
yeah,
what were some of the best? Yeah, especially in a shop that is still just like hiring their first or second or third account manager, like super early.
And names.
you know, it's funny. In the past 2 weeks, I've had the two weirdest interviews I've ever done in my life, and they both popped up very quickly. And it was like, whoa, this is wild. You know, I would say if you're brand new to it, and I recently just wrote an article, I think you guys talked about in Ink Kitchen about this. The one main thing is, do you like to spend time with them? Because if you don't, your clients aren't going to either. Unless, you know, like I'm totally, if we only sold into like corporate something, like that's not me. So maybe those people would like somebody that I don't like, you know, and hiring a variety is good. But I would say hiring people that you want to spend time with, that can communicate really well and like maintain banter, maintain, you know, that they can riff. If it's not somebody that you would want to have on a podcast, they probably aren't going to be a good salesperson or rep. So like somebody that you want to spend some time with. I also love hiring people in the food service industry. I think, Stephen, you mentioned specifically Starbucks, and absolutely, Starbucks baristas. And I also like to ask just questions that are going to kind of, I want people to be like, oh, that's a weird question. And then how they come out of that. Like I want to kind of put them in the weeds on a question and then just see what they do, because that's also what clients do. I always ask just like the two questions that you've probably read that I always ask is, what's the last book that you read? sometimes people just have an answer and it's straightforward and it's fine. And I'll ask a follow-up, like, what was your favorite thing about it? Do you often read stuff like that? Normally, though, people are going to be like, ooh, I don't read a lot, because, you know, a lot of people don't read these days. And you'll say, like, all right, what's the last, you know, show that you watched or thing that you binged, or what's your passion? What are you really into? Just get them talking about something that they like and see how they are, because that's going to be their more authentic self. And then I also ask, at your last job, or, you know, somebody recently I interviewed that's getting out of school, I said, you know, in school, you did a lot of group work. What would people in those groups say is your worst quality? What's the worst thing about you? And that really, that makes people be honest, but it also gets them talking about something that's a little bit uncomfortable. If you can still maintain that conversation and they're still really likable through that, they're going to be somebody that clients are comfortable talking with too. So those are the two things. That's kind of how I weed people out. I don't do a lot of questions. I don't have a lot of I don't keep it loose. I kind of ask like three or four very pointed questions that I would probably make fun of if I read like an article on LinkedIn, like, ask these questions. I would be like, this is stupid. I hate this person, but they're good questions. You know, it ends up, you learn a lot about these people. And in the end, you know, you're not really going to know until you try somebody out. So, I mean, that's, if I'm like, this person is, they've sold me, like in an interview, they're doing sales and service. They're selling to me and they are giving me customer service because I'm about to buy their labor. And if they can't give me a good level of service in an interview, that's a really good trial. Like, that's the service and sales that they're going to be giving your clients to.
I have definitely gotten sold in an interview, hired them, been like, oh yeah, they're going to be awesome. They told me all the right things. Like, I'm gassing them up during the interview. Week one, I'm like, oh shit, this isn't working. How do you, so like, I think what I'm getting at is there is a little bit of a gamble you're going to take, right? Like, you don't know how they're going to be until they actually accept the job and start. No matter what you do, you could probably call references, you could do all these things, you could give them case questions. In their first 2 weeks, what does the first 2 weeks look like if I'm working for you? And how do you ensure that they're successful? Like, yeah, what is that like?
Yeah, that's actually the first 2 weeks, and kind of how you train is very, very important. Having, you know, making sure you're not putting the cart before the horse, making sure that you're not, you know, let's just get you answering the phones before you know what's up. So first, what are our capabilities? Learning what our capabilities are and working in production. Having them work in production for a little bit not only has them learning a little bit about your capabilities, but it also builds camaraderie with them and the people in the back. It's kind of like if you hire a waitress, having her help cook a little bit. Our industry, you know, front of house and back of house is mirrors restaurant industry. So having them work in the back makes people in the back realize that this is somebody that will step in. This is somebody that isn't willing to, you know, that is willing to get their hands dirty. And it also gives you time during training to catch up on your stuff. You're not hiring anybody, or whoever is doing your training isn't doing this in a slow period. You're probably doing it because you're busy. So putting them in the back gives you time to catch up on your stuff, and it helps learn capabilities. Once you learn capabilities, then you can move on to, you know, going through the price sheet, learning the garments, learning internal communication, like how you do stuff, communicate wise. And then also, you know, if they put through a sample order, having them walk through that order through your shop. And if you have the capability doing that with them so that you can look at your shop from the point of view of an order, will make you catch so many things that you think that you know about your shop that you really don't. It's kind of like that I'm Just a Bill from Schoolhouse Rock. You want to be the order, like walk through, see who touches you, you know, figure it all out. You know, you're going to learn a lot. But that, I think that's a really good way to get them trained, to see if they're re-asking you questions multiple times. And also just to see if your processes suck. If your processes suck, and you're trying to train somebody on it, it might not be them. It might, there's a reason why you keep having to train people. But yeah, that's kind of how I do it. And then I have specific tests that I send people that are really, tactical. There's like four emails that I send and I say, you know, hey, can you quote me on this order? Treat me like the client. And, you know, if they ask you questions, just say, pretend I'm the client. If you have anything to clarify, ask them. You're going to fail. You're going to make mistakes. We'll go back through it when you're done. And that's kind of what I do is I start with capabilities and I kind of move them towards being able to quote me on some jobs. And then I slowly start moving them towards responding to clients with me copied in. And that's how I roll it out.
It's interesting. You kind of talked about like communication tools and like having a structure in place. A lot of shops will ask me like, I want to hire my first salesperson. I want to hire an account manager. I'm like, well, we have to get you off of like one Gmail inbox. Like, it's not going to work. You need to be on Slack or something, right? And so I think it's just very important. That point you made there is like, if your systems aren't set up for success, it will like, it'll swallow in and spit out a new employee like that, right? And so I think it's just very, very important for shops to understand there's like a baseline level you need to have and invest in that. Because otherwise it just looks bad. Bruce, you were going to say something?
Are you blocking off the first day? Or let's say, you know, you send them back. It's like, all right, hey, you know, Tony, can you let this person shadow you for 3-4 days, whatever it is this week? They're done with that. Are you, like when someone started with me, I had to clear off my calendar for a full day just to make sure, because it's so easy to get distracted on this and this and this, and then you're not really consistently actually training. Like what is it? Are you blocking that off? And then what does it look like? Is it docs? Is it Loom videos that you make? Is it, no, you're literally just sitting next to me for the next week or what?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, I set you up with an inbox before you start and an email that says garments, and it lists out like the garments that I like, the good, better, best, a couple different things like that. Another email that's like, here are the links that I constantly use. Make sure you bookmark them. And another email with price sheets. And that way you're always able to go back and reference those. When you ask me a question, I can say, go reference that email that I sent you. As far as time, I'm not blocking off really a whole time. I know that that first week is going to be really busy. You know, it's going to suck for the person training because you're kind of doing double work. But if you have other people and you can take, hey, I'm going to have you work with this person for an next hour and kind of just go over how we do emails, because I have everybody's inbox. We try to set it up the same. I think that it's easy to kind of have different people do different types of training. And that also gets them to kind of know your team. It like builds a team. As far as production, what I normally do is say, you know, if I'm like, okay, I'm getting a little overwhelmed, I need to catch up on some stuff, or there's a fire I have to put out, I'll go in the back and I'll say, hey, you know, Kevin in production, can you have them help you? Is there anything you need help on? Can you have them help you until the next break? And then I'll tell them, hey, after this break, come and find me. And then when they come and find me, I typically have another thing that they can start on. And if there's nothing, there's always go back into those three emails I sent you, study the pricing, go, you know, go over that stuff and find a question that you don't know that you can come to me and be like, hey, what does this mean? Even me, whenever I go through my pricing, there's stuff that I forget that we have on there. So there's going to be stuff that they're not going to know. When you do those sample tests for them to quote, they're going to miss stuff. And that's the whole point, is I put stuff in there for them to miss so that I can say, hey, you missed this. This is where it's at on the pricing. It's not super, super structured, because it really depends on the person. Sometimes people take a week and a half to get to the point where they can start emailing clients. Some people start to go back and forth with clients by the end of the first day. It really depends on what kind of experiences they have. Are they really fluent with Gmail? Are they fluent with email communication and customer service? Do they have a good memory? You know, there's a lot of stuff that it's based on. And I don't try to fit a person to a schedule. I try to fit the schedule to the person.
Interesting. But it's almost like in that first week, these are the different, what you're also trying to do is protect your schedule is what it seems like. So it's like almost like you have like summer camp for a week. It's like, here are 2-hour blocks of activities. And every day I'm going to plug you into a bunch of 2-hour different blocks. It might be with Joe in back. It might be go meet and greet this person. But it's like in the first week, we're going to get all these little activities done. And hopefully that also buys you time, because it is really hard to train someone. Especially as an owner or like a leader of a shop, like it is not easy. Bruce, you go pretty intense. Like, I remember your first week of work itinerary sheet or whatever. Could you talk about that you used to do, or if you still do it?
Tried to make it a plan as if I wasn't there. The goal was, at some point, I don't want to do the training because it is a lot. Like, especially if someone doesn't work out, you're just like, God damn, I just spent all this time. Now I got to start literally from ground zero again. It could be overwhelming. But, you know, can I have that first week really planned out? And so I created this doc that, you know, it had a schedule. It was almost like a high school schedule. It was, you know, you come in on this time. The first 15 minutes, we're going to do a walk around the office. The next 45 minutes, we're going to do intro to HR and all that. Then we're going to talk about, you know, benefits and setting this up and so on and so on. And then it went off into tracks. So depending on the department, it was a little bit more customized. We went into the company culture. And then, you know, if you're a developer, we start talking about that. If you're customer success, we start getting into that and setting things up. Yeah, the goal was maybe somebody could just read the whole thing by themselves and be able to do it. But obviously, you still have to assist them from there. So the tough part was just carving out time to do that. And what I did, which I remember with actually Adam Cook, was we literally just closed the door in a different part of the office building and just sat there for 4 hours, just like, what do we want them to do? And it, like you said, it's not perfect. And so when you actually go through that, you're like, oh shoot, I forgot about this, edit that. I forgot about that. We don't do this anymore. Delete that. And that gave us probably 80%. Of something that's reusable. And my gosh, I mean, just to pop open a doc, or like you said, your three emails that you could send over when someone starts is so relieving. It feels good.
Yeah. Not having to start from scratch is huge.
Yeah. And I mean, every time you do it, you get better and you don't make the same mistake twice when hiring an employee or training them. And so like you will mess it up the first couple of times and then it will get better and better and better. Zach, I want to ask a little bit about like industry specific. You've seen a lot of trends in our industry. You've developed new business. You've been through a pandemic. You've seen a business grow, pivot. You know, do you, you know, I'm getting a lot of feedback from shops that like business is down, sales are down, demand is down. For a company that has a pretty aggressive sales leader, do you feel that? Or do you think that's just like the stories we make up in our head because like industry's shifting?
I mean, so an old sales guy told me whenever I first started selling equipment, he was like, it's a clock. It always goes up and things will be up and then it comes down and then it goes up. And you kind of have to weather the storms. There's always going to be storms. There's always going to be ups and downs. I mean, I weathered the pandemic, but I also weathered the 2008 financial crisis. And before that, I worked at a shop during 9/11. I've seen those three things go up and down. I've seen people make mistakes. I've seen people buy 10 pallets of American flag stickers because they thought American flag stickers were going to just keep selling after the towers fell. And they were left with 10 pallets of American flag stickers because everybody thought that, you know, so, yeah, that was a really wild, they're the ones that developed the terrible towel for the Steelers, you know, the gold towel. They were the shop that first printed those. So it was a really weird shop, but, yeah, I mean, you kind of have to keep going. Like, you just have to keep going. And if it's slow, yeah, you might have to adapt. You might have to make staffing changes. But you have to, I mean, those are times where you really have to be innovating or branching out or figuring out what else can we do? What else can we cover with what we currently have? What can we offer that we didn't offer before? And, you know, still do marketing to the people that you're already working with. So like trying to keep people captivated and engaged that they might be slow. They might not have orders with you, but if they don't have an order for a year, but once a year they place an awesome order, you don't want them to forget about you. Or if they have a new rep, you know, a new person that's ordering every year, you don't want them to have to reinvent the wheel. You want them to know that you're the company that their company works with. So yeah, I mean, I think that a little bit, it is a little bit slow right now because there's a lot of uncertainty with tariffs and the market and the new administration and stuff. That every new administration, I feel like there's always a little bit of like people kind of waiting to see how the chips fall. And that's very much, I think, happening right now, but you have to just keep pushing. You have to innovate and, you know, keep reaching out.
You mentioned that actually, you said something about optimizing inbound. I can't remember the exact words. It was attack, extract, and close, maybe.
I just made that up, but yeah.
Oh, well, I love it. All right. I'll trademark it then. So attack, extract, and close. Like, okay. Hey guys, we going back to that original question. We need to rally up a little bit here. What is the next thing you're doing to help optimize your inbound leads? Cause I think adding some sort of outbound or going out, that makes a lot of sense, but I think that's a muscle or a skill that has to be built over time. It can't be like we can make a difference in the next 2-3 weeks. So optimizing that inbound funnel, what do you think about?
Well, does everybody that is coming in know everything that you're doing? Like, if one of your channels is just specifically on embroidery, do all of those people also know that you screen print and live print? With us, we do screen printing and decoration and all that stuff that you know, most shops listening to this do. But with the live printing, it's very different because a lot of live printing people, you'll see that like, hey, these live printing people, they're ordering, you know, embroidered polos from somewhere else. And you're like, wait, no, we do that too. Or conversely, like you might have somebody that does a ton of shirts through you, but they don't realize that live printing is a part of your business. It's whenever you asked me yesterday, like, what do you want to talk about? I wrote a thing about the gap between bear, like something about bear food lockers and there's a gap between like the lower
it was reading weird.
Limits.
It yeah, was weird.
But it's real. And so I didn't pull that out of my ass.
Hold on. I might need to pull it up because it was definitely, I had to read it 3 times. We were texting, you know, I had a podcast. Hey, is there anything we want to talk about? Customer service, how we communicate, and the overlap between a bear's ability to figure out puzzles and lower limits of the reading levels of national park goers.
Yeah. So, okay. So there was a big question when they asked like rangers, they were like, why, you know, when you go camping at national parks and a lot of places in the Smokies, you have to hide your food so that bears can't get it. And bears still often figure that out and can get it. And also there's a lot of people that can't figure out how to hide their food in there. And the national park people were like, there's a very big overlap between like how smart a bear is and kind of how dumb most national park goers are. So you have to figure out like how to make this thing to hide food that the dumbest national park goers can use, but the smartest bears can't figure out. And there's too much of an overlap to really do that perfectly. And I think that what I'm saying is that no matter how good you explain everything that you do and put it in writing and like put it in an email or add to your, you know, email signature or adjust your marketing, there's still people going to look directly at a flyer for screen printing and be like, what do you do? Like, no matter how well you explain it, you have to explain it every different way. Like there's no just easy, this is everything we do. Here's a flyer of all the stuff we do. If you do any of this stuff, come to us. People are going to see a part of it, go with that, and then ignore everything else. Or they're going to ignore the top part, see the bottom, be like, okay, you do live printing. Cool. I get my screen printed shirts from somewhere else. So that overlap, I talk about it a lot in, you know, with even production and customer service, like, well, it says in the price sheet, it has to be this size, or it says, you know, that we do color matching at this certain amount. So it says it right there. And I don't know. And it's like, you can't assume that people are going to read a thing and then take it in. With that is just reminding people the stuff that you do that they don't already use. That would be my first step in inbound marketing. Optimizing that is reminding the channels that are maybe live printing that you do screen printing, the embroidery channels that you do screen printing and live printing, and kind of cross-pollinate the people that are already working with you and bring them up to speed in a bunch of different ways. Learning is very iterative when you're training, but learning is also iterative when you're a client and you're really trying to educate people on what you do. Training a client is not that different from training a customer service person, and it's very iterative. You can't assume that what you have trained somebody on, that they have understood it, even if they repeat it back to you, even if they have shown that they know how to do it and that they know that you're doing a thing. A year later, they might be like, oh yeah, that's right, you do embroidery. And you're like, we talked about it. And it's like, cool. Did you talk about it once a month? Did you, you know, cross-pollinate those emails? So that would be my first step, is just cross-pollinating the inbound channels that you already have.
So one way that we do it at Campus Inc. is after you place an order, it'll ask, do you need any promo products with your order? So like after they place their order, they'll get their confirmation email. And then like a couple days later, it'll be like, hey, while we have your logo, do you know we do promo products? And it'll point it towards our Sage website, right? But the one thing that I teach my team to do is always bring a new nugget to the customer. Like always have something in your back pocket that you can always like show them. And it might be a product upgrade. It might be something new. It might be a different service. But every time you have an opportunity to interact with a customer, show them a different nugget. And a lot of times you're just kind of throwing it out there like, hey, just so you know, we could upgrade your hoodies to something a little heavier. Oh, cool. Or just so you know, we do have stickers. Do you guys want any? Or, oh, just so you know, you know, these hats would look great. Right. And I think a lot of times people will say like, how do I get more sales? And we just forget to ask and we forget to like bring new value to our customers. So it's just something, you know, if your order size is low, start upgrading your orders. You know, I'm curious to know how many shops actually ask, do you want a nicer quality shirt? Zach, do you try to like focus on upsells and upgrades and things like that? Is that something you push and promote?
We do a little bit of that. And we also do like, you know, if there's somebody that's ordering something and they don't order hard goods, kick them over to somebody that's like focused on hard goods and have that person really try to like develop the hard goods side of their business. It's a little bit tough because like when you're offering somebody something else, or you're telling your reps to do that, you're giving your reps extra work, but you're also giving the client extra work, you know, because they're like, do I want to take this to my boss and see if we want bigger hoodies? So you have to do it in a way that's like, what are they going to be interested in this? Like, ideally, if you have DTF or something like that, you'd be like, what's your address and size? Because I'm going to send you a hoodie with this design on it. Or like, if you have an engraver, it's like, hey, we do candles too. What's your address so I can send you a candle? That's hard to do. Like, that's really hard to get your reps to do. That's a lot of extra work and time. But I would bet that if you did that, you would get a lot more sales. It's just really hard to, especially when we hire, like we try to only have the amount of people in all of our shops that, you know, they can manage a full caseload. Like you don't have enough reps where everybody has only 4 hours of work a day and then 4 hours to kind of develop more. Ideally, that's what we would have, because then they would have a lot more time to do stuff. But we keep people busy in slow times, though. That would be crucial.
But it's something that like I'll commend Justin for doing it. Like I'll text with Justin and be like, hey, by the way, like we're doing these tote bags and like they're crushing. He's like, do you sell a lot of tote bags? I'm like, nah, not really. And he's like, I'm sending you one. There's one in the mail. And like on our sales rep desk, there's a tote bag. Now, have we sold any of them? No. But like Justin, and it sounds like you guys really just like, you don't really wait. It's not like, do you want a sample? It's like, hey, there's something in the mail for you. Right. And I think when things start to just like arrive, I think there's a lot of like, it's kind of like this way of selling a little bit. Bruce, you were going to say something?
It's top of mind because it's on the desk like that.
Sorry, I haven't ordered any tote bags from you guys, but thanks.
I mean, whenever we used to sell equipment, the best way to get in touch with like somebody through a gatekeeper was just send them something like overnight signature required in like a folder rather than an envelope, or like a thing that you actually needed to like unwind a string, like something that seemed like important. Like this might be a will, you know, spend $30 and send it overnight. It's going to get to the person and they might be like, damn it, I opened this. What is this? But I mean, even make it cheeky, be like, hey, you know, I called and I tried to get through to you and I lied and I said that I wasn't a salesperson, but I'm a salesperson. You know, you can throw this away, but honestly, if you just read it, you're not going to be pissed. You know, like talk to them like a human being, talk to them like somebody that doesn't have time to talk to you, make them laugh. And they're more likely to do it. The way that I got into SharpRent was I called and lied and specifically was like, I am not, because I did work there. But before I worked there, I sold them all their machines that for DTG, which got them the DTG portion of Threadless. Because I was working with Threadless and Threadless was like, we don't do it ourselves. We go to SharpRent. So I went to SharpRent, couldn't get through their gatekeeper. So I called and she was like, no. And right before she hung up, I said, wait. I'm not a salesperson. I know I sound like a salesperson. I'm not a salesperson. I actually really need to speak to James though. And like, he's going to be pissed if you don't let me talk to him. This is super, super important, but I promise you that I'm not a salesperson. And then he picked up the phone and I was like, James, I know she just told you that I wasn't a salesperson, but I lied to her. I was like, just give me 5 seconds. And then I ended up selling them a bunch of equipment and later worked for them. So it's, you know, take risks, you know, what are they going to do? Be like, he lied, you know, don't let him in the building, like whatever. Like, it's not about lying. It's make people laugh. Like, dude, take little risks. You know, if you make 100 calls in a day and one of them is like a complete Hail Mary, that's going to be the one that gets through. It's not like you have to do that on every call. And if you do it on 20 calls and you're like, ooh, those bombed every single time, then don't do it again. But like, try a little. Don't go off a script. Every person is different, so every sales call should be different.
What do you think is the best comp package for a shop to be able to use for a sales rep? You know, let's say their target earnings is X. Is it 50% base, 50% commission? Is it 100% commission? Is it 64? Like, what do you think?
I think for the shop, it's 100% commission, but I think that that is an unethical thing to do. If your business model is set up around that, I get it. You know, that's how it is at a lot of places. For sales reps, if they have a big book of business and you know, they're like, they want to do 100% commission and it makes sense, cool. But for somebody that's new, that's never sold before, I'm trying to get them to do that. If you pay them on a draw and you say, hey, for 6 months, we're going to pay you a commission. For 6 months, it's going to be a recoverable draw where like, we're only going to pay you, a base. We're going to pay you a base, but your commission is going to pull from that. And then after that, kind of move it once they're hitting the ground running. That's doable. I think it depends on the market and how much experience they have. If they have a ton of experience, they have a book of business, it can be more of a base and a smaller commission because that is going to benefit the company and they're going to be able to still, you know, be motivated. If it's somebody that doesn't have a background, a smaller base and a higher commission is going to get them excited. It's going to be more of a dopamine hit whenever they actually make a close. You just want something that is enough of a dopamine hit that sales is going to be addicting to them. And that really depends on market. It depends on what they're selling and it depends on the person. But,
and what about the commission then? Is it, you know, we've seen some that go very complicated by product category, a percentage like 5%, 3%, whatever. Some people try to do it net, you know, more of a profit-based percentage, and others try to do more gross. So it's very easy to calculate the percentage that they make. What do you think is best?
I think it depends on what your capacity is to track it and what your capacity is to give them trust that they're going to track it the right way. If you're going to dial into each thing and check out their pricing and you have somebody that's going to like audit all of their stuff, that's great. But the amount of money that you're paying that person, like, is it better served just giving to the sales rep and having them be more motivated? So it depends like what your margins are. It's really hard to say like what is one golden, you know, golden bullet or silver bullet or whatever. I think that having a decent base that they could get by, like a base that they could get by if they weren't buying eggs, you know, and they're like, it's pretty hard, but they could pay their bills, but like, they're not going to be able to last, 2 months with no sales. They have to make sales to, sustain and kind of thrive, but also enough where they're, if they are doing the amount of sales that you want them to, that they feel like they are part of the business, that they're your partner, that they are able to, have the type of lifestyle that close to you do, you know, you want them, if they're crushing it, you want them to feel like they can have an awesome life. If my first sales job in Chicago, I worked at like a sign shop for 3 weeks just to get here. And I remember they were like, you know, well, commission starts once you sell $200,000 a month. And I, at the time, I didn't know, you know, like I was real young. I had just moved here from Pittsburgh. I had like done service and art and stuff. So I took the job. I didn't really fully understand the commission package. And after I was like selling, I was like, nobody's ever made commission here. This is a $24,000 a year job, and you're trying to have me do commission. You are making what I make in a year off of every three orders, and there's never a way for me to make commission. Because it was a Fast Signs. Like, it's not, you're not selling McDonald's billboards at Fast Signs. You're selling cardboard cutouts of Mr. T and shit. So, like, it has to be something where people have the ability to be motivated. And to me, it's really all about that dopamine hit. You want people screaming at the top of their lungs whenever they get a sale. And a good sale is going to, like, sway their next month. Like, if they get paid the next month, like, a good sale is going to be like, oh my god, next month is going to be awesome because I just crushed it. If it's like the final day of, and they're crushing it, and the last sale on the 31st is like, oh, you know, I crushed it, and if I just make this one $75 sale, I'm going to be able to make rent, your package is wrong. Like, you need to figure out either a higher base or a higher thing. So you want people to be able to ideally, you know, live a comfortable life. And whenever they're walking around doing sales, stopping in at places, like, buy a candle. They should be able to afford some of the things that they're out and about, like, looking at clients, because one of the best things is buying stuff from your clients, like, building that relationship. Like, why don't you use me? I always buy coffee from you, you know? So yeah, you don't want somebody that's going out there just not able to afford any of the stuff that they're selling to.
I think the biggest advice I can give in our industry, I have over-engineered comp plans, built it too much off gross profit and all these metrics and, like, trying to hit all these things. And it was super complicated to track. We finally came up with, like Zach said, like, a healthy base salary where they can live comfortably and a smaller percentage on monthly sales. And then if they hit a quarterly target, they would get an extra kicker. And so, like, this has now been running for almost, I don't want to say 4 or 5 quarters. Last week was the end of Q1. And we had the most wild week in sales in the last 10 days because they were all just clawing to get their quarterly bonus. And so, like, the more simple you can keep things, the better, especially if those employees are going to be doing a mix of a lot of things. If you're going to have them out helping you with deliveries, and they might have to fold shirts one day, and they might be doing inbound, and they might be doing outbound, over complicating their comp plan will make them sometimes, like, they'll get a little shitty and being like, well, you had me doing this, I couldn't make money there. So, like, just know that when you build your comp plan, it's going to change, but not to overdo it when you're first starting out, for sure. So,
and make it in a way that if they're crushing it, you're not, like, being resentful because you're paying them too much money. Like, a funny story about Barrel Maker is, when I started, you know, I think that when we came in, it was like, okay, Zach, let's have him try to do, like, $100,000 worth of sales his first year. And we had all these, like, bonuses, like, at $100,000, you get, you know, an extra $1,000. At $200,000, you get $1,500. And then at $300,000, you get, like, free concert tickets or whatever. It was all these, like, benefit things, because we never really, we never thought I was going to get above, like, 200 or 300,000, but I ended up doing, like, $900,000 worth of sales the first year. And after, like, 400,000, it was like, hey, can we got to redo this sale. And it was like, dude, that's totally reasonable. Like, I was doing well. I was like, all right, the bonuses, they are, like, the next bonus was like, you and 4 of your clients can get a limo and go to, like, any concert in the, and it was like, dude, that's
Cancun, all inclusive, unlimited for 3 weeks.
It was more like, it was funny, you know, and it was like, oh, this is motivating for sure. But it got to a point where it was
Justin,
like,
sweating in his office.
Yeah, he was like, ooh, we got to talk about this. And we changed it. It was totally fine. The package was still great. And, you know, I made a couple of the bonuses, and it was like, hey, you're doing really good, but this isn't what I had in mind. And it was like,
I can see that in Justin voice, like, yeah, I fucked that up.
Toyota Prius at 1 million in sales.
It was a good problem to have. I mean, I bought like a yeah, it was crazy because I was selling t-shirts, but I, like, bought land in Michigan my first year. He was like, like, what's going on? And I was like, yeah. I don't know.
I'm just going up to my lake house, Justin. I'll be back. on Monday.
It was less than a used car amount of land, but it was really, really funny. And, you know, we changed it and it was collaborative. It was like, all right, let's talk about what could maybe make more sense. But, it is funny. Like, do make sure that if they're crushing it, your compensation package is going to be something that, you know, you will still want to do and that you're happy about. Like, you want their goals to be aligned with your goals.
I think the two things that help me and then wrap is the number one, you will never have a solid incentive commission plan, as in it will change and that is okay. And so like everyone's always trying to make positive motions to the right one, but you probably never get to the right one. So like you're always in the middle and like accepting that is fine. And then I think the other thing on top of that is letting the team know about that. I mean, we said, look, we're working on this, but quarterly we're going to review this plan and making sure we're incentivizing the right things. I've definitely had plans that incentivized what I thought would be the right things, but did not. It pushed the salespeople to do something that I did not want the outcome of. And you'll know it because it'll happen and your numbers aren't going to look like what you expected. And that's the incentives working, but working in the slightly wrong direction. So it's okay then to change it quarterly and, you know, claw back the Porsche that you just gave Zach.
I'm going to total it before you take it back. I'll tell you that.
Guys, we appreciate you guys listening to this episode with Zach. Zach, thank you. Thank you for being able to share so much behind the scenes and the sales and the customer service side of Barrelmaker. Print Hustlers, we'll see you guys. We'll see you guys next week. You guys are awesome. Thank you so much for being able to join us. Have a great week. Thanks so much for listening. Hopefully that was informative. Don't forget to subscribe. Don't forget to like. Don't forget to hit the bell for notifications if you enjoyed this video. If you enjoy all the stuff we're putting out, it's really helpful. We love to just be able to see it. That means that we're doing a good job. To subscribe, hit the bell for notifications and hit the like button. And I'll see you in the next episode. Bye.